And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Welcome to your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, everybody.
Oh, my God.
Your friend in podcasting, Phil Lairness, the guy.
1 week before I've singled him.
The guy whose voice keeps distorting, who keeps thinking he needs to shout, who keeps thinking he needs to shout over me.
I was excited, but...
Is a man that you... look, you found him riotously funny in Vancouver Theatre Sports League.
Did you remember that?
You found him heroic and yet eccentric for... 11 seasons of The X-Files,
sure.
And a big screen movie, and a spin-off series. But really, where you fell in love with him was this coming weekend as the best man in my wedding. It's Detroit's very own Dean Haglund.
Hey, hello, Rock Dean. City Motown. Oh, yes. Thank you very much. It's fun to be in Los Angeles, sitting around your living room 1 week before your marriage. Oh, my gosh. It's palpable. The energy... The pre-purchased Amazon gifts that are lining the walls of this place is fantastic.
Also joining us, my fiancé.
Oh, to rhyme with Beyoncé.
No, that's not why that's a thing.
Oh, I thought that was, that's why you said that.
Lily Holloman, welcome back to this podcast.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is awesome. You have a purring cat on you.
Fuzz all
over. And I know that she's purring because this mic is picking it up.
That's not true.
Yeah. It's picking up the purr. Like, we should just do, quite honestly, that's all we need for a show is an hour of a cat purr.
A fuzz purr.
And then sell it to those white noise machines.
I'm looking at Fuzz in the eyes, and she has, like, one eyelid lower than the other. Like, she's totally just fallen asleep.
No, I think she's looking at you askance.
Oh, I oh.
She does see, not. She doesn't not trust entirely me. Trust you.
Oh, I see. Oh, I thought she was so relaxed.
I don't trust you either.
Well, so I agree.
Watch yourself.
Hey, I see why you picked me as the best man. That keep you on your toes.
We have been sharing stories of terrible bachelor parties.
Yes.
Back and forth,
and we're not sharing them on the show.
No, we are not.
Because they're terrible.
If you had tuned in, I don't know. I was going to say if people had tuned in a few minutes earlier. If I'd hit record a few minutes earlier, we would have been able to actually, on this show, have a live event of the week, and it would have been puppetry of the penis.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Let's not bring that up either. Anyway, here we are. How are you feeling? You, nervous? I bet.
Do we want to talk about that? I mean, we're
sure.
Going to be... Do we want to talk about wedding stuff?
I think everybody wants, everybody
overwhelmed,
knows.
Overwhelmed,
yes.
Stressed out,
yeah.
Really low on sleep because there's so many things that's... That
well, you're micromanaging this thing to the nth degree. You need a wedding planner. I mean, your seat planning, your flowers, the opening video montage at the...
But, you know, here's the reason why, is that you do all this so that you can enjoy it. We've been to a lot of weddings where the married couple...
Didn't plan it out.
Yeah, it's not necessarily that they don't enjoy it as... No, that's exactly it. They don't enjoy it. And so we want to be fully present, and
yes.
After the fact, we don't ever want to feel regret in any way. So it's what do we want to celebrate, and
right.
How do we want to celebrate it?
Excellent.
So yes, we spent the weekend doing the seating assignments, and I mean...
That's tough.
I don't know what the table number is anymore because the table numbers changed, but the assignments stayed the same. right?
Yeah.
The table numbers were initially the order in which you set up the tables, but then we changed the numbers based on where those tables are in the room to make those easier to find. Because, you know, you've been to the rooms where you go like, wait a minute, why is table 12 next to table 1? How does this work out, right?
Right.
It's crazy. It's like a scavenger hunt trying to find your table. So, but I will say this, in the original countdown, table 13 was the table to be at.
Ah, damn it. So wait, what's the final count of number of guests coming?
Well, that would be the amount of people attending.
Thank you. And what's the budget of the film?
That's the amount of money you have to make.
And so how many people are actually coming to the wedding?
Well, this is interesting. I mean, we have a final count that is still fluctuating.
What do you mean? Some people haven't agreed to come?
A couple people have told us they're coming. Lily doesn't think they are.
You don't trust your friends?
So to hell with that guy. Not count them.
Oh, I see. So you didn't give them a table.
So it's interesting because I believe that there's maybe 207 people on the seating chart and 205 people is the head count.
I actually put that person in. I believe them. And took one person out.
Wow. That was me, wasn't it?
Yes.
I'm not sure.
Dean, we've called you here tonight. Because...
Yeah, guess what? You know what? If I come, it'll be hilarious.
Yeah.
And if I don't...
Even more hilarious.
Even more hilarious, yeah. Right? Think of the comedy. I'm all about surprise gags.
If you come, your best man toast will go over very well.
If I don't.
If you don't, you will have left people wanting more.
Are you guys going to do some Laurel and Hardy kind of physical comedy?
Oh, no. I mean, during his toast, though, he's got to pick somebody to do his arms.
I'm not doing any improv in my toast.
Oh, you're not improv. You're writing it out in advance?
Patty suggested, I just for safety's sake... So, one run in front of her.
One of the things that people say, right, is speak from your heart.
Yes.
So let me say to you, Dean Haglund, that is an organ deep inside your body.
Well, thank you. Oh, my God. I was going to just riff from my butt.
Puppetry of the penis.
No, we're not doing puppetry. Oh, my God. Could you imagine I did that at your wedding? Hey, ladies and gentlemen,
name an animal.
I know to do the story of their relationship with puppetry of the penis. What the? This is awkward. Stop it.
That's what moved into the Bob Baker Marionette Theater.
Did not.
Oh my goodness. That was my favorite Bob Baker show.
Puppetry of the penis? They never did puppetry of the penis. That was a legitimate Broadway hit. How do we not talk about the history of theater without talking about that show?
Actually, it was off-Broadway.
Was it? I thought it was main stage. I thought it actually was like the Neil Simon or something.
I mean, maybe. Gosh.
I have like show business topics that I wrote down for us to discuss. Do we want to?
Yes. I want to get away from puppetry of the penis, and I might refill our glasses while we're...
Should I pause?
No, keep going.
Are you sure?
Yeah, no, bring up the topic.
Oh, this is great, the part where we're talking about should I pause. It's great. Well, I mean, do we want to get to a serious topic? You know what? I don't want to bring the room down. I mean, we're having so much fun.
Oh.
So I feel like the only thing that I have scripted that continues to be a lot of fun is let's talk about celebrity deaths.
Celebrity deaths.
Fuzz didn't like that. She tried to get away when you said that.
Because I got up.
So, I mean, the one... Well, there's a couple that we have to talk about. One happened today, and we're not going to get to it.
Today?
But, yeah, Stargate actor. We'll talk about it next week.
I got
that. But Albert Finney. Mm. 82 years old. English actor.
Yes,
right?
Brilliant.
Yeah. Worked in film, television, theater, attended the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art.
The Dresser is my favorite film.
Did you go to RADA?
I went to BADA.
BADA.
British American Drama Academy.
Okay.
Right.
British American. Really? Okay.
Yeah. Expats.
So, he went to RADA, began to work in the theater as a Shakespearean actor before attaining prominence on screen in the early 60s debuting with The Entertainer. We've talked about this film, Laurence Olivier.
The Laurence Olivier stand-up thing.
Laurence Olivier is really kind of scary.
He taps into the anger that a lot he found that as a fascinating touch point. I always think it's weird when I see that.
So that was where he got his start. It was directed by Tony Richardson, who had previously directed Albert Finney in the Theater.
Mm-hmm.
So he's known for what? He's known for...
The Dresser, isn't that his...
Well, you keep going to The Dresser. I mean, what about... Isn't Tom Jones the movie that makes him kind of an international superstar,
I saw it in school, but
that's 1963.
Right.
I guess Saturday Night and Sunday Morning was a big hit for him. The Audrey Hepburn film, Two for the Road, in 67.
Give me that.
How about his Scrooge in 1970? That was kind of interesting.
I don't know if I've seen that one.
Annie, he plays Daddy Warbucks in 1982. John Huston.
Right.
Can you imagine Albert Finney and John Huston kind of hanging out? That's fun stuff.
Some stories.
The Dresser. Academy Award nomination for Best Actor for that.
So good.
A little bit of a comeback for him because he'd had some bombs.
Oh, is that right?
During that time of his career. Not that Annie was a bomb, but what about the Coen brothers' Miller's Crossing?
Oh, yeah. You know, he was the only reason to watch that thing, right?
Well,
I'm not a big...
I mean, Gabriel Byrne's
good.
The acting is good. I felt always that the second act of that movie, the second half of it, isn't up to the standard of the first.
Not
act.
My favorite, the Coen Brothers.
But still, very early, and really to go from Raising Arizona to that, showed
range and ambition.
Miller's Crossing is the kind of movie that now I feel like the Coen Brothers could master in their sleep.
Yes, for sure, I agree.
He's Aaron Brockovich. He gets an Oscar nomination.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Of course, he's in Tim Burton's Big Fish.
Mm-hmm.
He's in The Bourne Ultimatum. That was a big hit. The Bourne Legacy. How about replacing Sean Connery in Skyfall in 2012?
Oh yeah, right.
Four Academy Award nominations for Best Actor. Tom Jones, as we mentioned. The Dresser, as we mentioned. John Huston's Under the Volcano. In 1984, and Murder on the Orient Express.
Right. Holy shit.
Invisible, almost, under all that makeup.
Yeah, for sure. I forgot that.
And, as I said, nominated for Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for Aaron Brockovich. And, quite frankly, I was sort of surprised that he didn't win for that. I think Benicio del Toro won for Traffic that year.
Maybe.
Do you have any favorites that I didn't mention?
No. For
Big
me,
Fish.
I mentioned Big Fish, but that's one of your favorites?
It's the only one I remember.
You didn't see The Dresser?
No.
Well, you remember Murder on the Orient Express, though, the original?
Well, that's true, yeah.
But he's under so much makeup, I didn't even realize he was in that.
Right, I know.
I know.
What about his performance as Winston Churchill in the HBO thing, The Gathering Storm?
The Gathering Storm, yeah.
Really good, right?
That was good.
Let's see, what else? You know what was what it continues to be unsung a movie and a performance is Ridley Scott's 1977 film, The Duelists.
Oh, yeah.
Keith Carradine and Harvey Keitel and Tom Conti, who he would later be with. I'm thinking Tom Courtney.
Tom Conti.
But The Duelists, yeah. Albert Finney is one of the leads.
Kevin, you know, he's such a good actor that you sort of lose his structural face, actually, when you think about his performances. Like, he's enveloping the character so much that everything you said I've seen, and I go, oh, yeah, that was him. But now I'm like, did he have he had a lot of makeup in Orient Express, but...
Yes, absolutely.
But now... I didn't.
And he was such a young man, too. No. That's the other thing about it, is there's a degree to which... Not that... this is apples to oranges in most ways, but like Angela Lansbury...
Yes.
Who was actually young when she starts playing old people.
Manchurian Candidate.
It always shocked me when I would see Albert Finney. Like, you see him in Aaron Brockovich, and I would say, wait, how does he look like this? He looked like this 30 years ago.
Yeah, right.
But he was pretending to look like that 30 years.
I know. Angela Lansbury, Michael Chiklis. There's certain actors that always looked way
older. Angela Lansbury and Michael Chiklis have just been grouped together, ladies and gentlemen, for the first time. And that's why you tune in to Celebrity Deaths.
Those are two actors.
Okay, I want to also, we love celebrating the character actors. There is an American character actor who died within the last couple weeks at 90. His name was Dick Miller. Ooh. If I showed you his photo, you would know immediately who he is. He appeared in more than 100 films, gets his start in supporting roles in a whole bunch of Roger Corman-produced films.
Great.
But so many of the directors who began their careers with Corman, guys like Joe Dante, and James Cameron, end up casting him in big roles when they're doing major things. He always played kind of beleaguered everyman characters. So his most famous films are Gremlins.
Okay.
And Gremlins 2. The New Batch. He was in Little Shop of Horrors. But in James Cameron's The Terminator.
Who was he in that?
Oh, God. Again, you'd have to look up his face. But just one of these guys who you always loved when you saw him. You know, there's another actor. I'm trying to remember. Oh, my God. I'm struggling because of all the bottles of wine that we've had. But there was just in the 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, there were these kind of really beleaguered, masculine character actor figures who would you just go, oh, that guy.
That guy, right?
And
you see him all the time, but I don't think that role is ever as available as it used to be.
No.
Unfortunately. No. You know, the beleaguered guy is now kind of dissipated, maybe. Yeah. Maybe they write that for a larger range of both male and female, multi-ethnic, whatever. You don't see just one guy doing all those roles anymore.
Stay awake, Lil, because we're about to get to a competitive round of celebrity deaths. Mm. But before we do, James Ingram, we go from Oscar-nominated Albert Finney to Grammy-winning James Ingram, dies at 66. He topped the charts with the hit R&B song Baby Come to Me, which was a duet with Patty Austin, which reached number one in 83.
Okay.
Big fixture at high school dances for this kid. He first came to fame just 2 years earlier when he sang vocals on the song Just Once, which was also a huge hit, and 100 Ways, both of which were on the Quincy Jones album, The Dude.
You know what? I must have been in a punk band for so long. I know. All of this.
Look, R&B and soul and black music, not your thing, Dean. We understand.
Wait, that makes me sound so racist.
Canadian.
Okay, maybe Canadian.
Died at the age of 66, James Ingram of brain cancer, Grammy winner for Song of the Year in 86 for his duet with Linda Ronstadt on the song Somewhere Out There, which was the theme song to what animated film?
5-0 Goes West.
No.
Very close, but the original, not the sequel.
Oh, I forgot that wasn't the original.
An American Tale.
An American Tale. Right.
He had previously won a Grammy.
That was scary, actually. How fast you can pull that out.
He had previously won a Grammy for the aforementioned 100 Ways, as I mentioned, on Quincy Jones' album, The Dude. Okay.
So wait, American Tale is the first animated thing, and then 5-0 Goes West is the sequel to
Right, yeah. They both focus on 5-0. Yes. Okay.
5-0 the Mouse.
Yes. 5-0 the Mouse, voiced by...
Burt Reynolds?
Bob Newhart.
Oh, no. Who?
Bob Newhart, didn't he do the Little
Mouse? I thought Burt Reynolds was one of them.
Oh, maybe Burt Reynolds.
Lil, you apparently have all the expertise the on this.
I mean, 5-0 was a child, so I doubt it was any of those grown men.
All right.
Okay. Any of those grown men?
All right. Okay. All right. Fair enough.
Yeah, right.
More puppetry of the penis? Anybody? All right. Okay. So first, we're gonna keep a score on this competition.
Okay. Lily's one up, frankly.
We're going to give Lily... No, that was a warm-up, but...
Okay, she gets half a point for knowing the sequel.
So we're going to start, since Lily should know this, because I'm going to play on the basis of gender stereotypes.
She's
Lily
a lot of pressure to put on your fiance.
So Dean has to go first.
Oh, damn it.
Dean.
Yes.
Dead at 65, Rosemary Mariner... What was Rosemary Mariner's claim to fame?
Wow. Fantastic. I'm going to say she was the voice of Sugar Pups.
Okay, so Lily, I don't have to tell you because you already know this as a feminist, as someone who champions female history. Take over an organization that until just a few decades ago didn't even allow women as members. You're a president of that organization. So trailblazing women is something that you know about throughout history. So I don't have to tell you what Rosemary Mariner, the answer is in her name, she was the first woman to do.
She co-founded Ms. Magazine.
With Gloria Steinem?
Yeah.
No.
The answer is in the name, Rosemary Mariner?
I'm
going to
say she's
Mariner?
The first person to sail around the world by herself.
Okay, you're closer. She was the first female Navy fighter pilot.
Navy fighter pilot.
Mariner.
F-16 landing on the big cruise ships.
But also get this, as if that wasn't enough. The first woman in the military to command an operational air squadron.
See?
She was chosen in 73 as one of the first 8 women to enter military pilot training. She went on to become the first woman to fly the A-4C, the A-7E Corsair II.
Oh, that was a tough one.
She later served on the staff of the Joint Chiefs in the Pentagon.
Okay.
Wait a second. Lil will want to know this. After her retirement from the military in 97,
yeah,
she taught military history at the University of Tennessee.
Fantastic.
And was an advisor to the Department of the Navy, as well as both PBS and ABC News. Dean Haglund.
So, many women flew and tested during World War II because so many men were trained as pilots and sent into combat that women stayed in California at the Northrop Grumman, Lockheed,
and
building.
We do know they were test pilots. We do know that.
Right.
Yes.
And so they had actually made many world record firsts in testing not just propeller but jet engines. And Chuck Yeager, who owns 57 of these world records, it is said, did the exact same thing the women had done previously, but did it so that a man could be in the world record
book.
Okay,
all right. So, again, we were very specific about being the first Navy fighter pilot.
Right.
But, Dean Haglund,
yes.
We're going to erase your negative points for that. And so it's Lily at -2 because she did not hold up her gender on that.
Wow.
So -2 points for Lily Holloman.
So wrong.
0 for Dean Haglund.
You know what? I want to get -2.
Wait a minute. Wait. I had 0.5 to begin with.
No, you didn't get any for the warm-up question.
No, for the feeble. She got 0.5.
Right, but that was a warm-up question. Okay. All right, but she didn't know that. She was in the
game. This show is
so
rigged.
We're back to rigged. We're back to 0-0 then. All right, like, which makes this next question all the more important.
Okay.
It's something that Dean should know
off the top of my head.
I mean, this is...
I should say it in my sleep.
Yeah, I mean, they would take away his Canadian... birthright. Geez. If he didn't know this, please put more pressure on this person,
I don't know.
So we go to Lily first, then, for a chance to steal. Ron Joyce died at 88 years of age, Lil. Before Dean has a chance to explain to us what Ron Joyce's claim to fame and lasting cultural impact was, what was it? Why do we love Ron Joyce? Who was he?
He invented the Hot Pocket.
That is a Canadian thing.
Which is my favorite, by the way, of all the puppetry of the penis tricks. The Hot Pocket.
Oh my God, that's so wrong.
That is incorrect and has nothing to do with Canada.
Right.
So Dean Haglund, don't look it up. Don't let him look it up.
I was looking it up.
Don't let him look it up.
Ron Joyce, his name for some reason is familiar with KTEL products. I'm going to say.
Was that Canadian though?
That K-Tel? Was Canadian. Yeah.
That was very good.
KTEL Records and like everything.
Pocket
Fisherman.
We're gonna not deduct any points from either of you because Lily's answer was delightful and Dean's was actually very interesting and insightful in its own way. But both of you, sadly, wrong.
Damn it,
Lily. If I say. We're at Jamaica Station, and we're desperate to find out what bus we're supposed to take to the Barclays Center. And then I say Ron Joyce co-founded something. What would the answer be?
He co-founded the New Jersey Transit System.
No, Tim Horton. He was the co-founder of Timmy Horton Donut
Chain. Oh, him and Tim Horton.
The Timmy Hose.
Oh, Timmy Hose.
Because it was a Timmy Hose in the Jamaica Station.
Right, and
not
you know what?
Dunkin' Donut.
I said Timmy Hose in Detroit. No one knew what I was talking about.
Fuck those people.
Oh, my gosh. And I also.
But they would know who James Ingram was, and you didn't.
That's true. I went to Timmy Hose, and I had the waffle chicken sandwich, which I took a picture. It was the. Not. To disgrace the beloved institution that is Timmy Ho's, I'm just recommending they take the waffle chicken sandwich off the menu.
Off the menu.
Please, for the love of...
Maybe the world is just not ready for it.
Well, let me just say that the size of it in the commercial and the size that it was my thumb is for $4.95 and I got a thumb-sized waffle. With a chicken McNugget, maybe? Maybe. It was a McNugget.
The most delightful thing I heard on the news recently was some commentator bagging on the food at Mar-a-Lago saying it was the wedge salad is not recommended.
Well, and if you go to Trump Towers restaurant in the lower level on Fifth Avenue, apparently that is so greasy and gross that it is continually mocked as the worst place to eat in Midtown.
Because of all the bad hombres that they're letting in.
Yeah, well, that's it, right?
Edward Birdsong, we're not going to make this one which one of you is going to be able to answer a trivia question about Daft Punk? But Edward Birdsong... Significantly, the name of the speakeasy that we might drink at on Friday.
That's
but 77, he was an influential keyboardist whose funk jazz grooves, I don't need to tell you more than that, were sampled by many hip-hop artists, including De La Soul, mm-hmm. Gangstar.
Mm-hmm.
Gangstar sampled Birdsong's Rapper Dapper Snapper on their iconic song Me, Myself, and I.
Oh my gosh.
And, Daft Punk sampled Coal Bottle Baby on their 2001 hit Harder, Better, Faster, Stronger. Now, Birdsong was a session musician who played with Stevie Wonder and released two solo albums. So that's another one of the notables that left us. Okay, here we go. Back to trivia question.
Here we go.
I'm going to give you more about this person.
Okay.
And then we're gonna zero in on a specific part of her notoriety. Louisa Moritz... was 72 years old when she died. She was a Cuban-American actress, best known for playing Rosa in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Remember the party gal that gets brought in insane asylum there, right?
Okay.
She did guest appearances on Love American Style, Up in Smoke.
Love Boat?
Lots of television, Love Boat, Match Game.
Company?
She really embraced the blonde bombshell character and played it for laughs. Always had this real joy that she brought to it. But she was one of the first seven women who did what?
Seven.
First seven. Now, she's a star. She reached the height of her popularity in the 1970s, and she was one of the first seven women who did what? Dean Haglund.
Start a bowling league. No?
Come on.
Come on.
We're gonna talk about her second career in a little while. Her second career involves the law. One doesn't necessarily follow the other, but I will say that she was one of the first seven people to do something that does involve legal proceedings.
Ah.
One of the first seven women to do what?
Sue.
You're on to something. You're getting warmer.
I like it. She's suing for sexual harassment.
You're getting so close.
Sexual harassment.
Put the 5 seconds on the clock.
Class action.
Wrongful termination.
No. So, Lily Holloman, you've got a few moments. One of the first seven women to do what? Think in 1970s. One of the first seven. Which means there are many, many more women who have done this. But she was one of the first seven to do what? Probably relating back to the height of her career in the 1970s and perhaps something that took place backstage at The Tonight Show.
Sue for residuals.
We were on this edge of sexual harassment. Oh, I didn't get my residuals for being on a rerun of The Tonight Show.
She was one of the first seven women to accuse Bill Cosby of rape.
Bill Cosby.
Oh, that's not fun.
You were
building that up like it was going to be a fun answer.
No, it's a historical answer.
It's a historic answer. I mean, it's fun. It's fun if you like the idea that serial rapists ultimately get brought to justice.
Okay, you know what else?
What else? I mean, do we want to hear about the rest of her life?
You know what? Let's hear about the rest of her life.
So she has a second career. She built her acting career playing these ditzy blonde bombshell types. But in 2004, not only have people said that it was an act, but she proves that the ditzy blonde character was an act when she embarks on a new career as a lawyer. Sure. She passes the bar exam on her first try.
Look at her.
And becomes practicing in bankruptcy law.
Fantastic.
This is what's interesting. She later gets disbarred, however, because she fails to respond to multiple attempts by the California Bar Association to contact her.
Gone.
So, to a degree, the ditzy blonde always in the mix. That was the sound of some more wine being poured.
Oh, she was.
What is this episode of Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour brought to us by? It's brought to us by a lovely Pinot Noir and...
and Fuzz Aldrin for all your cat needs.
Lil, Julie Adams, follow me on this,
mm-hmm.
Okay? Julie Adams left an indelible mark in pop culture. She was an actress. She was born in Waterloo, Iowa. Spent much of her youth in Arkansas. Mm-hmm. She was winner of the Miss Little Rock pageant before moving to, Hollywood.
Yes.
Signed by Universal, appeared in a slew of Westerns. Are you following me, Lil?
Yeah.
Her co-stars include the top leading men of the age, Jimmy Stewart, Rock Hudson, Charlton Heston. Okay. Later in her career, she had a recurring role. On Murder, She Wrote, as the eccentric realtor, Eve Simpson.
Well, yeah.
But she always remained a fan favorite for her appearance in what 1954 horror movie? Lily Holloman.
Return of the Blob.
And that's good.
Is there even a Return of the Blob?
Yeah, because there was the Blob. And
there was the Blob several years after. So they decided to do the sequel before the Blob.
Yeah.
You know, by the way, at the wedding reception,
yeah,
on the dance playlists.
We do the Blob?
Don't kid yourself. The Blob is one of them. All right.
How about New Mexican Puppeteer?
No, that's not.
I'm
going to
bring that up.
The
in my
young
speech.
New Mexican Puppeteer.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Oh my God! One of my favorite things. One of my favorite kind of nonplussed insults that I've ever received. We're driving through Arizona, I think, and I'm singing along to Paul Simon's Graceland, and Dean looks at me, and I said, "It's Paul Simon's Graceland." And Dean says, "Yeah, and you know all the words, apparently."
I did say that.
Yeah. Yep, I think you even tweeted it or whatever. Okay. What 1954 horror film is Julie Adams so fondly remembered for?
Dean Night England? Of the Living Dead.
That was 1968.
Ah, yeah, right.
And that was not it.
Oh.
Return of the Body Snatchers.
No.
Forbidden Planet. Why is it always Return of? Why would you go with the original? I mean, she's so fondly remembered for a sequel that never happened. Okay.
The Body Snatchers.
I'll give you both a quote of her bio. Let me see if I can do her bio, if that'll... she had a bio in 2011. I mean, this is going to give it away. The Lucky Southern Star, Reflections from the Black Lagoon.
She was the woman for the Creature of the Black Lagoon.
Yes, she was.
We met that guy, the creature.
The creature who wore, the guy who wore the suit?
Yeah.
Really?
He's at the monster convention.
What, the one in, we were all in, in Texas?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So you know what? So you know what else is very cute is we mentioned her 1980s Murder, She Wrote role. In the 1970s, she actually played Jimmy Stewart's wife. They had worked together in the 50s on the short-lived 1971 sitcom.
What?
The Jimmy Stewart Show.
That never happened. How is that possible?
Look, in a world where puppetry of the penis happens, how can you put it past us to have had a Jimmy Stewart Show
sitcom? Was a sitcom from 1971.
All right, Lily has left, but the question goes to, I think, Dean first. Does Dean get first crack at this one, Lil? We're still
tied.
We're tied. We got tied a 0-0 score. It's fantastic.
We don't know.
Okay. Died at 52 years of age this past week. Christoph St. John. Who was he?
Okay, go ahead, Lily.
Dean gets to go first.
Oh, I'm first.
Cause of death has been deferred.
Oh, my gosh.
As, quote, pending additional investigation.
He was engaged to a lovely Russian woman, and he was a long-going actor on a long-running soap opera, Young and the Restless, if I'm not mistaken.
For 28 years.
28 years on Young and the Restless.
And one of the stars of the first soap operas ever to focus on African-Americans also. Right. Christoph St. John, yeah.
Christoph St. John.
28 years.
And so they thought alcohol was involved. They said non-suspicious was the result of his death at 52 years. So one thinks, I'm saying this out loud, that one just did some hardcore drinking and didn't wake up from that. Much like Alexander Gutnoff, the famous actor from Die Hard, apparently drank so much vodka his heart stopped.
Mm. Okay, so I'm going to give you, Dean Haglund, a point for knowing who he was.
Yes.
A point for, an additional point for knowing the soap opera.
Yes.
And another point for knowing something about his death. That's 3 points. I am taking away a point.
What?
For bringing up drinking deaths in front of Lily Holloman just a few days before the bachelor party. So that's...
Well, no, this is the whole point. Your bachelor party will not end in a drinking death.
Well, as far as I know. What a wonderful
That's all I can promise.
That's all you can promise. That's 2 points. And I'm taking away another point for still not knowing about the Timmy Horton co-founder. So that's...
Yeah.
So you get 1 point, Dean Haglund.
You know what?
And that brings us to, I believe, our final one. So, Lil, you need to get 1 point to tie, 2 points to win.
Go, Lil.
At 93 years of age, Harold Bradley passed away this week. We have visited so many of the places so important to him when we have gone to weddings in the not-too-distant past. So, Lil, I expect you to know who Harold Bradley
I expect you to know.
Is. Harold Bradley.
Harold Bradley was born in 1925.
Excellent. Keep going.
He...
You get a point for doing the math correctly. That we have a tie right now.
Damn it.
He was probably active in the Korean War.
Okay.
Which was so important in terms of the places we have visited for weddings. Because so many of the weddings we have gone to have been akin to land wars in Asia. Civil wars.
Wait, where is this wedding going to take place?
So I'm gonna take away that point, but I'm gonna add a point there for it being funny. So okay, we're back to one. It's
he's
one
a
to
very
one.
Active pilot.
A pilot?
Maybe we. I don't. I have no
Isn't
way.
Isn't there a Bradley Airport somewhere?
Mm-hmm. Tom Bradley International Airport.
Yeah,
he's the mayor.
So you're right about all this. You're right about all this, and I have no way of knowing whether this man was a pilot or not. So I can't take away points from this. But let me just ask you a yes-no question. Was he a member of the famous A-Team?
No.
Well, he was. He was.
No, that's what I call a softball question.
So let me ask you this. No. What was the famous A-Team that I'm asking about?
The A-Team with Mr. T?
No, that's the wrong A-Team that I'm asking you about. I'm asking you about something from your Tennessee roots, really, honestly. All of this has been about Tennessee.
There was an A-Team.
Where have we gone to Tennessee weddings recently?
Okay, so he defended the Alamo. He was a volunteer.
The Alamo, one of my favorite spots.
Mexican American War.
One of my favorite spots in Nashville, the Alamo.
But that was the volunteers. The Tennesseans came into Texas.
Dean Haglund. Right.
Yeah.
So he's 93 years old. You just thought that he fought in the Korean War, and now you're putting him at the Alamo.
The Alamo.
You can go either.
You can do both
wars. You can go either way with those 93 years.
What? So you're saying 93 years, but not all in a row.
Yeah.
Okay. We just found him dead. I mean, he might have been dead for decades.
Minus 93.
Okay.
I was told there'd be no math.
Dean Haglund, any idea who Harold Bradley was?
I'm going to say he was a member of the A-Team in Tennessee.
You have gotten that correct. You get 0 points for that.
What do you mean? Okay, so if...
What was the A-Team in Nashville, Tennessee, do you think?
I would think it is the band that backed up Elvis at Sun Studio.
Ooh, not bad.
So the A-Team was a group of musicians.
Yeah, right?
Who played on hit songs at a variety of studios.
Not just Sun Studio.
But by Elvis Presley, who mm-hmm. recorded at Sun Studios.
See?
Roy Orbison, who recorded at Sun Studios.
Mm-hmm.
Loretta Lynn. He... was not only a Country Music Hall of Fame guitarist instrumental in creating what is known as the Nashville Sound. But he, wouldn't that be a great name, by the way, for a baseball team? We're the Nashville Sound.
We're the Nashville Sound.
But he also, this is pretty damn cool, he led the local musicians union.
To strike?
He brought about better working conditions. And he was a key person in the creation, Lil, of Nashville's Music Row district, which we drove through.
Where you see the handprints of different musicians?
Sure. No, it's just a bunch of little houses.
It's a little bungalow houses. It's like a residential district.
Oh.
But in each different, like each different one of these houses, there would be
some
a record
famous,
label or
some
or
famous
a music attorney or a publishing company. And you would just walk down the street in this residential district and make a deal, and that's Music Row. It's becoming heavily developed and gentrified and all this now.
It.
But it's very, very cool. What university is that near?
University of Tennessee, I would
Vanderbilt.
Say.
Well, Vanderbilt is nearer There's another university right there at the end, but we don't know. But anyway, we have a winner, and that is Dean Haglund.
Holy smokes.
Dean Haglund won this week.
I can't believe.
But I got Five Will Goes West.
I know. He didn't even get a single answer. But that was
a real answer.
He did get a real answer.
Oh, you got the soap opera
guy. He got a real answer, and you got Five Will Goes West, which you keep using as your like calling card, and I hate to point out, but that was the wrong answer. You keep falling back on a wrong answer.
But it was a really good call, though.
It was a good call and wrong.
Yeah.
All right.
That's tough.
What do we want to talk about? Do we want to talk about women in the media? Do we want to talk about the British Academy Awards? The differences between those two are so negligible.
They're so negligible. Yes, the BAFTAs.
Let's talk about the BAFTAs.
Let's
the BAFTAs
explain
took place
the BAFTAs.
This week, the British Academy of Film and Television, the Film Awards, interesting, always so interesting in terms of what they can foreshadow about the Oscars.
Absolutely.
Because that's where they're important.
And that's still where it seems they celebrate acting as the Oscars.
Well, that's the question that I want to pose to the two of you. So, best film, Roma. You would hope. I'm not sure Roma is going to win the Oscar for best film.
Oh.
We know the Academy loves to spread it around, and if they're giving it best foreign language film, and they're going to give him best director, might they not give another movie best picture? That's my question.
Very good.
But this is an award show that is actually geared towards honoring films from around the world.
Right.
As opposed to the
Oscars. It has to be. By the very fact it's in London.
Best actress, not Glenn Close, who has been winning all the awards here for
favorite.
A terrible movie.
Yes.
For a movie that's not nominated for anything else anywhere. It's an actual bad movie. And Dean, you know my pet peeve about can we stop awarding people for their supposed great performances in movies that don't work? If the movies don't work, does anybody deserve to get acclaim?
Well, I think you do, because if you are working very hard to rise this piece of crap above the pedestrian, then you should be celebrated for your skill set of rising above the pedestrian.
But we're not saying that it is necessarily the pedestrian, but isn't it possible that one of the things that undermines a movie is if a lead performer is not in the same movie that everyone else is? We know a lot of lead performers. Johnny Depp is big on this, right? It's like, oh, I wish I was seeing the movie he was in. So that's the way that I feel about it, is that also if you're sitting there going, well, this movie isn't very good, but oh, that person's great. Well, if you're aware of their performance, is it great?
Right,
because
you're not seamless and you're not embodying the actual reality.
You're not seeing a real person, exactly. You're not seeing the reality of it. So, anyway, they did not give it to Glenn Close. Instead, they gave it to Olivia Colman, so deserving for The Favorite.
The Favorite.
You would hope, I mean, dear God, if they didn't give it to her in Great Britain, where the hell are they going to give her Best Actress?
So, you know, it's for my thing, it's like, but that's an ensemble piece. Is a triangle of performances.
That's true.
So you're not going to... It's so tough to go, hey, that one person where the other two are supporting...
But that's also why it's refreshing for that to be rewarded.
Yeah, then. I guess.
Leading actor, and I guess this is now a foregone conclusion for the Oscars, and I honestly just can't fucking believe this because he's so badly miscast. He's embarrassing how awful he is. Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody.
And I thought you were championing this when it first came out.
Or, well, certainly when the announcement came of him replacing Sacha Baron Cohen.
Right.
But I do believe a movie with Sacha Baron Cohen playing Freddie Mercury would have been a more interesting movie.
I agree.
And the fact that he dropped out let you know that it wasn't going to be an interesting movie. Because he said, I'm out of here.
Right, this is not what I want to do.
So I'm wondering, does Rami Malek, who we love for Mr. Robot...
Yes.
Is he getting the reward for not letting the major investment that a major studio put into this movie get flushed down the toilet when Bryan Singer disappears.
Okay, so...
Is Rami Malek getting an award for basically saving a company's bacon?
That's fascinating. This suggests, then, that the awards are purchased. They are purchased by large, powerful production companies, and that we are not secretly gathering our ballots to determine who is actually the best, which we know is the case. There
well,
is
do
money.
We not do we not vote, whether it be for politics or for awards, do a lot of us not often vote for narrative rather than for any idea of criterion for that particular category or that particular job? We vote for narrative.
Right.
But how did that movie do in the box office?
It is the biggest hit biopic in history. It's the biggest hit musical-based film in history. It has made almost $1 billion with a B dollars worldwide. And as I keep saying to everyone, look, I don't want to take the smile off anybody's face. If you like this movie, good for you. Much like if you like Queen's music, good for you. Yeah. I always liked Queen's music, but let's not pretend that they weren't shitty. They are a shitty fucking band. Their music is really cheesy, and I love them. God bless them. I love them.
But oh my God, I just listened to Another One Bites the Dust.
Yeah.
And that sounds like a better version of everything Michael Jackson tried to do.
I'll never forget the Rolling Stone article when Crazy Little Thing Called Love, their last big hit, comes out. And they said, hey, this is a good song, but one listenable song in an entire career doesn't make them good. And that was the review. And there is something to that. I mean, it's really cheesy. Their stuff is always really cheesy. Does that mean that we can't love it? Of course not. I love Barry Manilow, for crying out loud. What? Lil loves Billy Joel. These people are just sort of talent free, but we love them. And people love ABBA. As I understand it, there are entire movie musicals based on the songbook of ABBA.
Yes.
That's shocking. That sounds like a horror film to me.
I agree.
But there are people who love it, and God bless you for loving it. Mm. We love Tom Jones, Young New Mexican Puppeteer. But anyway, point that I'm making I don't deny it the $1 billion box office gross that I tip my hat to. But
because everybody
Oscar,
had to see it.
But an Oscar for Best Actor?
But it's nostalgia porn.
Ah.
So,
well, no, that's not a but. That's an and.
That's the point.
It's nostalgia porn, and so people have a hard time distinguishing between the euphoria they feel for being in this nostalgic place surrounded by Queen and something that's actually good.
So this is my question, right? Is the test of time. Like, Sean Penn penned an essay on Deadline talking about the shame of Bradley Cooper being overlooked as best director for Star is Born. And I don't agree with him about this, but the point that he made was the Academy always embarrasses itself by being so much in the now that they don't think at all about how history is going to look at this.
I agree.
Crash for Best Picture.
Chariots of Fire. Have you watched that thing recently?
Well, the most famous is Around the World in 80 Days, where it wins Best Picture because Michael Todd, the producer, takes every one of the Academy members out to a meal. they change the rules because of it. So there are things that don't hold up well.
Right.
And honestly, a couple decades from now, you show Bohemian Rhapsody to people and say this was the best actor performance, and the response is going to be, I didn't know that Jerry Lewis was still acting.
Bizarre. But, you know, we can go year by year all the way back to 1929 when you realize that they actually changed their vote before the Academy was voting. the very first best actor for 1929's Oscar ceremony was going to be Rin Tin Tin, the German Shepherd dog that they were going to give an Oscar to.
Oh.
And they went, oh, we shouldn't give it to a dog. We should give it to somebody who could perhaps speak on the radio that would then garner more viewers to the movie. And so I believe it was changed to Wings, Howard Hughes.
Yeah, Wings. Yeah, I don't know who the actor was.
But the actor was there.
Well, so. Look, I still would pick Rin Tin Tin over
a German Shepherd.
This is my requirement. I would say this. If Rami Malek, if you are going to win Best Actor at the Oscars, you've been quite a gentleman about, you refuse to speak about what happened with Bryan Singer. Beyond yes. saying it was not, he said it was, suffice it to say, it was not pleasant working with Bryan Singer. That's all he said. You got to come through with the goods in that Oscar speech, or we're taking that statue Oof, away. That's
too
what
much
I want.
Pressure.
Best British film was The Favourite, so the Brits played it both ways. They played it safe, giving both The Favourite. And this is one of those Oscar years, I must say, those award years, where it's so disconcerting and so confusing, because I'll be on these shows and people will keep referring to The Favorite and I keep thinking they mean The Front Runner.
And they say The Favorite.
Like, The Favorite won't win. Like, how come in every category they're picking an upset? I don't understand. I keep forgetting that there's a favorite. Best Documentary, Free Solo. Best Animated Film, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which I think is going to win the Oscar.
I think so.
Original Screenplay, The Favorite. Adapted Screenplay, Best Black Klansman. And I think Black Klansman might win an Oscar, which would be, unless I'm mistaken, the first time Spike Lee wins an Oscar.
Absolutely. And, you know, as a working artist in the actual medium of film, that's a guy who has steered through ups and downs of career highs and whatever. He's just followed his own. I hated a lot of his stuff he did. I loved a lot of his stuff he did. But Jesus, give that guy something for just choosing a path of an artistic expression.
And I have no doubt, I feel exactly like you do. There are some of his movies where I just go, oh God, this is such a workout sitting through this. But I have no doubt that the movies that I do enjoy exist in part because of the movies I don't enjoy.
Yeah, exactly.
He's following his path.
His path. But it's also, he's getting feedback from the path he's taken, right?
Absolutely.
So when there's failures, he embraces that failure, and then it informs the next thing he does. So
Supporting Actress went to Rachel Weisz, which I thought was very cool, because I thought, how hard is it to, again, tell about that, you know? Well, first of all, there's also Emma Stone is it Emma Stone? Yeah, Emma Stone is nominated with her. So the splitting of votes and the politics of that.
Ridiculous.
But there's no denying that Rachel Weisz does a great, great job. And of course, supporting actor Mahershala Ali. The Oscar for Best Supporting Actor has had Mahershala Ali's name on it for quite a while.
Half an hour?
No, for quite a while,
right.
Actually.
Years.
For more than half an hour, since before Green Book. You know, Lily Holloman, we'll see if she's right, but she sees Green Book months ago before it comes out, and as soon as she sees it, her summation at the end of it is, there's your Best Picture winner.
Really?
So we'll see. We'll see. The last time she's made a statement like that was months before the conventions, and she said, you know, Trump's going to win.
Oh, I was going to say Chariots of Fire.
So we'll say Chariots of Fire.
Well, I mean, definitely would be the Best Picture winner if it was like 1998, so.
All right.
Well, now that's a qualification.
So much of my acting and stand-up would have been really funny.
All right, two more topics I want to get to. We have time to get to this, because God knows how long the show is with all the stops and the wine and everything. But
Do you want more wine?
No. Maybe.
Here we go.
So we referenced this briefly last week, Dean, when we were driving to downtown.
Yep.
So Time's Up has issued a 4% challenge. And this references how 4% of the top 1,000 box office films of the last decade were directed by women.
Yes.
So Time's Up has issued a challenge to studios to hire
one
woman to direct a project within the next 18 months.
How hard can that possibly be?
I hope they mean one woman per studio and not one woman at each studio.
Like, well, I thought you just meant one woman, period.
Ever.
Exactly. Yeah. That one woman's going to be really easy. But for 18 months. So I kind of did the math on this about how any studio film is guaranteed to be in the top 1,000. Even if it's a huge... Like, John Carter from Mars probably was in the top 1,000 box of, because it's not about how much it loses. It's just based on how much it grosses. And the marketing budgets alone guarantee that a failed studio film is going to make more than most independent films ever will. So if each of the major studios hires one within the next 18 months, well, then at the end of this decade, you are safely going to be up to 6 or 8%. Yeah. So congratulations. Problem solved. Where do we begin with this?
Where do we begin? Because you have... there's Oscar-winning female directors out there. I mean... You and I have gone through 1 year where we pointed out great films from female directors.
We sought out films by female directors to review.
Yeah, remember that? That was like 2 years ago, 3 years ago.
And I noticed something this past year, and we talked about this, that I wasn't seeking them out, but lo and behold...
There they were.
They were here, and I was no longer thinking about them as female directors.
The great directors.
Like, my favorite director. I saw this movie, I told you about it a little bit, Zama, from Argentina, I think it was, from South America. It really didn't get much of a release here. Lucrezia Martel. And I was reading about this woman. And lo and behold, I'd seen one of her earlier films. But everywhere outside of America, she's basically hailed as, like, the equivalent of Alfonso Cuarón.
Wow. Okay.
Like the pantheon of great current filmmakers anywhere in the world. And that's it. There are so many of these. Lynn Ramsey, Sarah Pauli, Deborah Granik. Yeah. So many of these women where it's just like, if they direct a movie, I want to see it. It's not because anymore I'm seeking out women
female directors. These are artists that have an expression that you want to see.
So, hire a woman for a project. I'm going to start here. How about this?
What?
The challenge maybe ought to be, within the next 18 months, every studio has to finance and greenlight a project that a woman director brings to them.
And that there... You are standing on a platform we can get behind, because it is one thing to go, oh, we are scheduling, you know, these superhero movies. Here's the sequels that are going to come out from now till 2025. Who are we going to slot in on directors that can deliver on time in this budget, that can handle these difficult actors? These are all, you know...
And who gives us a little bit of a marketing
Marketing
push
thing. Yeah, right, absolutely. There is a level of studio directors that have nothing to do... A la Brian Singer, frankly, that guy actually wrecks them more than he does. But he's got, you know, somehow he's got the...
A certain cachet.
And the bona fides with the studio and the enough connections, whatever. You know, I don't attest to know.
Well, we talked about this with what was the woman's name? Is it Patty Jenkins who directed Wonder Woman?
Yeah,
biggest hit film ever from a woman. And her first movie since she directs the Oscar-winning Monster 10 years earlier, something like that. She directs Charlize Theron to a Best Actress Oscar. And she doesn't direct again until she does a superhero movie. I've got a lot of questions at that point. Now, she's directed for television, but how is a woman going from an Oscar-winning film to not getting another movie on the big screen until it's a superhero movie? And I'm not criticizing superhero movies. No. I'm criticizing the system that she doesn't get to make the movies that she's generating.
And I know this from... conversations I had back in the 90s, and it's, you know, these movies have to deliver a certain number of things. It becomes product locomotive, as we said before. These aren't movies, these are product locomotives. And the only person who can deliver a product locomotive is a journeyman guy who can deal with difficult actors, air quote, difficult actors. Someone who can bring in under $150 million, big explosions, can navigate, be basically a traffic cop at that point. Fuck your artistic...
well, and hopefully is bringing in something marketable, too. That's the other thing that we're thinking about. Like, we're casting directors for the same reason we're casting actors, which is who is some kind of quote-unquote bankable name, which might mean a little something different for actors and directors, but it means, in the case of director, who can we rely on for money and time and who has a certain bona fide cachet that won't make the fanboys kill this project on the internet before it's made.
Yes.
So that's why we're doing it, not who has a great handle on this material who's bringing something interesting.
Right. We can't go through that because how do we determine who's got a great handle on that? This is not one board meeting. This is a conversation.
So this is my problem with the Time's Up Challenge, is that you've issued this challenge where you're trying to put studios in a position of, oh, the bad press they'll get if they fail.
Right.
So now, why they're hiring is another expression of risk management, which is the whole fucking problem with the game to begin with.
Exactly.
Risk management. Instead of pushing them, you know what? Look at this list of women filmmakers. We can even submit a list of women. Each of you, hire one of them to make a project they want to make.
Yes.
Okay. So that's one angle on Time's Up.
Uh-huh.
Lily Holloman, who's falling asleep. So Time's Up almost on her yes. appearance on
and
the
I,
show.
And I do have to go myself.
But we did a little bit of a Time's Up fundraiser at the end of a Lady Killers screening recently. And one of the things that I wanted you to speak to, Lil, that came out in this screening was not just about the bad behavior that women are on the receiving end, the hostile environments that are on the receiving end, but something that really started to dawn on me, which was how difficult it is for women at any level of show business to stand up for themselves and speak up on behalf of themselves, not just when, quote-unquote, something harassing has gone on, but just to stand up for themselves in the way that a man would defend not only their rights, but their ideas.
An artistic ideal.
An idea, a workplace idea, anything. And this is one of the things that came out about how historically difficult and still difficult I think it is for women in this position. This is a whole, you know, in violence prevention, we always talked about how do we believe that it is possible to create a society where relationships are free of violence? Absolutely we do. But we also would tell people that that's where the work begins, because the goal is to create healthy relationships, not just relationships free of violence.
Right.
You have to have it free of violence to be able to plant the seeds for healthy growth. So it seems like, you know, we're so at the beginning of the first conversation, mm-hmm. which is how do we eradicate the destructive behavior? And what occurred to me that night, really viscerally, was the big work is all the decades of women not feeling comfortable speaking up for what they needed, for what they wanted, for what they believed, for ideas, that playing field has not been the same to them.
Right.
Well, the conversation is really still very basic at this point, and because women have historically not felt comfortable speaking up, they're now, a lot of people are overcompensating and misinterpreting speaking up for being sort of defensive and argumentative. And so I feel like there's room to sort of step back and actually look at what this was before we weren't speaking up, so we can understand it better, which is when I've found myself in situations where I needed to sit up, stand up for myself.
Now would be the position you need
yeah,
to sit
exactly.
up.
Yeah, exactly. It wasn't that I didn't stand up for myself. It was that I physically could not do it. I did not have it within me. It was not in my makeup. There were no words. My body would not let sound exit my mouth. So it really was not a choice. It was what I had historically been conditioned to be like as a woman. And it's daily micro-messaging saying that this is not your place, this is not what you do, this is... And it's really nuanced engagement that is kind of hard to detect, and you really have to sit with it and understand it from a very basic level, even before any kind of bad interaction with a man. How easy is it for women to know what they want, period, to know right. who they are, period, to express who they are genuinely? That goes for men too, but women have this handicap.
And this micro messaging
yeah.
that you said, this to me is fascinating, because it's like I never in my head think I'm micro-messaging anything.
Exactly.
So that there's a perceived micro-message coming.
Yeah, there's a micro-message that nobody knows about. For instance, if I'm not listened to when stating a fact to mm-hmm. somebody, and they just brush me off and they disagree... Mm-hmm. I don't automatically think, oh, it's because I'm a woman or because I'm diminutive or have a high voice or whatever it is. But then a man comes along and says the exact same thing that I say. And then the person
All right.
then agrees and listens to them. You start to kind of realize this dynamic that's playing out. Or, for instance, I'm the head of an organization. I'm the president. And people will defer to Phil as the one who is in charge, men and women.
Well,
and it's fine. It's just is unconscious. Well, because
but you know, that's an interesting point. And this is why it's so important, and why we say it's healthy. You know, we could get really meta into this and talk about how, you know, even in abusive situations, one of the reasons you want to create a healthy situation is for the health of the abuser as well as the health of the abused, because it's not healthy for anybody.
Yeah.
But in this society, it isn't healthy for anybody. When Lil says it's fine in these circumstances that people go up to Phil to tell them something. That is, it's not my department.
You're not
at
department.
All. It's not my department at
all. You don't
all.
Know shit about it.
It's all Lil. Yeah. And they're coming up and telling me, and then I have to go and tell her. And the thing is, I don't like this. I don't want to be this is putting a pressure on me. Why am I receiving this? This
yeah,
is
right.
not my responsibility.
And this comes this micromanagement thing, that I'm fascinated by that term now, because micromessaging and micromanagement... the way my head works, I work in a general space, and so any micro anything that I'm, air quotes, giving off, shocks me to no end.
Well, so how much have I now, having been making movies for more than 25 years, how much do I have to be aware of not necessarily behavior, of overt things that I did that created a hostile workplace or an unfair workplace, but how much of a blind spot did I have to the fact that people, men and women, didn't enter in to an equal space to begin with.
Yeah, didn't bring it to the table because...
Whereas, exactly, I might have thought, no, I'm treating everybody the same.
Right, here's an open table.
But treating everybody the same doesn't mean it's taken the same way because one group of people might fear going further.
Right.
My experience is my experience, which is if you have not only a belief in your idea, in what you have to share, not out of a sense of ego, you try to learn really quickly, is this my ego speaking, or no, am I the holder of this idea that we would all be well served to pay attention to because we're all working so hard.
Yeah.
We want this to work out. I'd better fight for this. But a woman might not be in the same place at all. Right. It gets shot down once, that might be it.
That's enough.
And that might be the idea that everybody needed.
And right, the glow of the ember.
And one of the things when you're in a position of decision making, you do push back on people's ideas. You do push back because it's that kind of fire that tests the metal of their creative idea.
Right.
And if it can withstand the pushback, you go, okay, you're on to something.
Right.
And as I've been teaching, this is one of the reasons why I go more and more often to a phrase that I always heard our friend David Dean Bottrell use in his classes, which is always asking people, men and women, after having a discussion, does this make sense to you?
Yes.
Because I want to find out, are we speaking at the same level? Do we understand
it? Yes, right. Is it resonating at the right level? Or the same level? Resonant in a personal level? So, it to me, then it becomes, filmmaking right here, because it is the most collaborative of all the art forms I do. Painting, drawing, stand-up, all of these things, they're very much a thing where I... sit in a room, I come up with jokes, put some, marks on paper, that sort of thing. That's very individual. Filmmaking, I need to hear from everybody involved, male and female. So one would hope that is an open playing field for all ideas in. And yet in a micro-messaging term, now I think that I'm... that 50%, 85%, I don't know what the percentage is not being included in that creative process.
No, even if you're someone, this is the thing that's eye-opening for me, is even if you think you're going into a place going, I welcome all ideas at all times, that might not be enough.
Hmm.
You have to counteract what came before.
Right.
Because... people are coming with their experience.
And that baggage.
And their experience taught them, don't speak up. Or they don't even have it in their coordinates.
To know how to speak up or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fascinating.
And so, we have the a lot of examples that were given about how sometimes women don't speak up because you get a reputation. That person's difficult.
Yes. Yeah.
Difficult.
As opposed to a man who's a perfectionist.
Right. Or
who's
artistic
an artist,
genius.
Or a genius. Or fights for the thing. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm going to hit you with something that... how about the other, though? You know what? I'm not going to hire her. She was really quiet. Didn't contribute a lot.
Did not. She didn't add to the process.
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
And why... I bet it had to be a thing. But it had to be a thing. Especially behind the camera.
Mm.
No, I had this talk with a director and a producer going, why do you guys hire all these jerks all the time? And they said, well, we don't know where the genius comes from. We think it comes from the crazy. You know, no. And it was me and this other, and we like, we go out of our way to not, make it difficult on set. And stuff like that. And they're like, yeah, we appreciate that. But we hire the crazy because we think that's where that guy's going to hit it out of the park more than the guy that is super stable. And sure enough, I was at Casa Vega on Ventura on a lunch with a guy I'd never seen before, and I don't remember his name, and he had a series because he was bragging how he got to keep the Armani suits from set. He took the wardrobe from the series he just finished. And he said to me, "Oh, hey, you got your own series, The Lone Gunman, and spin-off on The X-Files." I go, "Yeah, yeah." He goes, "Did you pick your day yet?" You know the story, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And the day was, "Well, what day is that?" "The day you freak out." I'm like, "Hmm? I'm not going to freak out." "Yeah, yeah, you're Canadian. You're not going to freak out. But you should just put an X randomly on the calendar. And just when the third AD knocks on the door going, "We're ready for you, Mr. Haglin," slam the door in that guy's face. Go, "I'm not coming out." Second AD is going to come, knock, knock. "Mr. Haglin," "Nope." And slam the door on that guy. First AD, "Hey, Dean, is there a problem?" "No, fuck you. I can go talk to the director." The director comes in. "Dean, what's up?" And goes, "And you make up anything." "Go, oh, I don't know the scene. I'm having trouble with my character." "Whatever. You can do whatever. That guy's going to sit and talk to you for half an hour." And you're like, "You can say whatever. Just both go, you know, my dad never loved me, or I had this acting class." "Whatever. Just talk about whatever." And you go, "Okay." And he's going to say, "Did you get this scene?" "Yeah." And he goes, "So much has happened in the time the third AD and that director's come in. That will be like an hour. And in that hour, if you're in Vancouver, there's been a phone call to L.A., that there's a difficult actor on set, and B, that director has stepped in your trailer and has dealt with it, and he's, and all you do at the end of that is go, 'Yeah, I'm fine with it,' and go out and do what you were going to do anyway. But you have now created three things. All the crew members on set now really think you're taking it seriously, that this is not something you're just phoning in. B, the director can now be hired to deal with difficult actors because he talked that guy."
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, wow. He talked that guy out of a trailer for half an hour. So that guy's going to get a ton of work. And then the third thing is you are a fucking artist. You are bringing whatever this crazy energy is to the fucking camera. And you are brilliant. And you're not that guy who doesn't cause problems, who just is phoning it in. You're the magical genius of whatever. It's like, I'm not doing that. And I never did it. And now to this day, totally regret it.
So, that's a perfect example of if a woman did that, she would be fired.
Right?
Guests of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn. In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles. Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas. Belated spoiler alert.